Okay, so this is Bio 241, and it's Thursday, February 3rd, and we're in the middle of chapter 6, or beginning middle part of chapter 6. So this is kind of like a physical chemistry chapter, which is excellent. This is maybe one of the most important chapters in the book. So it's really good to get a good basic understanding of how everything in the world operates, right, just by its physical chemistry, because your body has to behave the same way. And so there are two ways that molecules can move around. Well, maybe two ways you could break these processes down. Passive transport and active transport, right? One way molecules move will be from high concentration to low concentration, and that's a passive process, does not require ATP. But to go from low concentration to high concentration, right, that's an active process that requires ATP in your body to do that. All right, so we started talking about the simplest kind of transport first, and that is a passive kind, and in particular diffusion, things moving from high concentration to low. So here is just the last slide to recapitulate everything that we talked about diffusion. All right, the rate of diffusion is directly related to a number of parameters. So that means that if any of these parameters right here increase, what happens to the rate of diffusion if it's directly related? It increases as well, okay? Then there are some other parameters. If they increase, what happens to the rate of diffusion? They decrease. We say that's inversely related to the rate of diffusion. So let's look at these different qualities of the system. If the concentration, the magnitude of the concentration increases, so does the rate of diffusion, right? So if the concentration gradient is really, really high, so if there's really low concentration in one area and high in another, the rate of diffusion is rapid. If the concentration is equal in two different places, can you tell me about the rate of diffusion if they're exactly equal? As a matter of fact, it stops, right? And as the concentration increases a little bit, the concentration gradient increases a little bit, the rate increases a little bit. And if the gradient becomes greater, the rate increases, right, and so forth. The permeability, if there is a membrane between two compartments, things can only diffuse if they can actually get through the membrane. If the membrane is a barrier that doesn't allow for diffusion, then diffusion cannot take place. Like if we have that perfume bottle right here in the room, and if we have the doors open to the hallway, where is it going to go? Into the hallway as well. But if we close the doors, what happens? It wants to go into the hallway, but it can't get through the door, right? So it's stuck in the room. The other thing is temperature. As the temperature increases, what can you tell me about the rate of diffusion? It increases as well, right? Because it's directly related. As a matter of fact, temperature is really a measure of the vibration and motion of molecules. And so as the temperature increases, molecules just vibrate more, they mix more, so that increases the rate of diffusion. And also, the surface area of a membrane. If there's a membrane involved, if the surface area is really big, then more molecules can move across it. If it's a really small membrane, then not as many molecules can move through. So think of surface area as being a doorway. As a doorway gets bigger, more people can move through the doorway. If it's a really tiny little door, then very few people can get through. If it's a big garage door for like a car, a lot of people can move through that doorway at the same time. Okay, so these are directly related to the rate of diffusion. But the rate of diffusion is also controlled by how heavy a substance is, and that's what we call the molecular weight of a substance. So as the molecular weight increases, the rate of diffusion decreases because something gets heavier. And we can look at the periodic table over here on the right-hand side and figure out what the molecular weight of something is, and that is by this number right here underneath the chemical symbol. So if we get a mole of magnesium, it's going to weigh 24.31 grams. All right, so that's just the weight. So all of these molecules, of course, get heavier and heavier and heavier as we move down the table, and even when we move over to the right as well. So what's the lightest element that we have on this periodic table? It is hydrogen, right? Okay. So hydrogen would be able to, what, diffuse the fastest because it's the lightest molecule. Another way of thinking of that, say I'm at a stoplight on my motorcycle and there's a semi-tractor truck in the next lane, okay, that's loaded with groceries or something, a big truck, the light turns green, who's going to get through the intersection first? Me on the motorcycle or the truck? Let's switch places. Say somebody was on the motorcycle and I was in the truck. Okay, just to take me out of the equation. Who would get through the intersection first, the motorcycle or the truck that I was driving? The motorcycle, because it's lighter, right? That's just the way it goes. All right, so you should be familiar with these concepts right here. Okay, here is another passive process. This is osmosis. All right, there are three important criteria in order for a process to be considered osmosis, and you got to know what those are. All right, the key was on that slide upside down, but it is also on this slide right here. So let's just define osmosis. It's the net diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. Okay, so in order for a process to be osmosis, it's got to be a certain kind of molecule. And in this statement right here, what is the molecule that's moving? It's water. And you should also know, what is water? Is when you have a solution, what is a solution made up of? A solvent and a solute molecule. And what is water? It's the solvent. So really what you want to put in here, to be the most general, it's the net diffusion of the solvent molecule. But in biology, what is that always going to be? It's going to be water. In other kinds of maybe chemistry experiments, it might be some other solvents, but for us, it's always going to be water because we're interested in human physiology in here. All right? And what else can you tell me about osmosis? Is it active or passive? That's contained in this statement right here as well. It's passive because why? Because it's diffusion. So it's got to be diffusion, and diffusion, you know already, is that it's a passive process, so it's the passive movement of water. And the third criteria is that there has to be a membrane associated with that transport. And that membrane has to have a special property, namely, it's got to be selectively permeable. There's another way of talking about it, and sometimes we just say semi-permeable. Right? So selectively permeable and semi-permeable are exactly the same thing. So how is water going to diffuse? Which way is it going to go if it's passive? High concentration to low. That's the only way diffusion works, right? So it's going to, what we say, diffuse down its concentration gradient. It's going to move from water, okay, H2O is less concentrated, where there are more solute molecules. Okay, what does that mean? Let's look at this chamber right here. And these dots, let's just say that they're blue. I don't know, they don't quite look blue, but they're close to blue. Okay, these are the solute molecules. So we have more solute on the right compared to the left. So which chamber has more water? The one on, well, the right has more solute, so it's crowding out water molecules. So there are actually more water molecules here on the left-hand side. Okay? All right. So you have to realize what the solvent is and what the solute is. So I want to define that for you. So the, oh, is this color the same as this one right here? Ah, excellent. Okay, so these, solute, very good. And these small molecules right here, like a lighter blue, that's a water molecule, which you don't see on this, on the, in this chamber right here. Okay, so we have more water over here, high concentration of water, low concentration of water on the right, and we have a membrane between them. That membrane has pores in it. And these pores are big enough to let the water molecule pass, but they're too small to let the solute molecule. So solute is what? Impermeable, but water is permeable across the membrane. So since this membrane allows some molecules to go through, but not others, it qualifies as being what? Selectively permeable. So this is a nice proper example of osmosis. And water will go from high concentration to low, and it's going to move into the chamber on the right-hand side when it does that, just by a passive process. Now, in order for osmosis to work, these larger particles right here have to be too big to move across the membrane, right? That has to be a selectively permeable membrane, and when that condition is met, we say that these solute particles are osmotically active, which means they can't freely move across the membrane. They're stuck on one side or the other. So that's all important for osmosis. All right, so let's do another little experiment right here. Let's put some glucose solution in these two different chambers. We'll use the same kind of membrane, and we'll say that glucose can't move across because it's too big, but water can because it's small enough to fit through the pores. On the left-hand side, we have 180 grams per liter. On the right-hand side, it's twice that. Glucose is twice as concentrated, which means that which side has more water? The left side, because there is less solute right there. Okay? In the beginning of the experiment, the volume is exactly the same. All right, so glucose can't move. Glucose wants to go from right to left, but can it? Well, it wants to go down its concentration gradient. It can't because it can't get through the membrane. But water is small enough, it can, so it's going to want to move to the right-hand side. And so when a lot of water molecules move through little pores in cells, sometimes we call those aquaporins, the little pores that allow water to move through a cell membrane. When water moves from the left to the right, then the size of the right-hand side chamber has to get bigger because it's getting more molecules, right? So it pushes the membrane out just like that. All right, now, when does the diffusion of water stop across this membrane? When the concentration gradient disappears, right? When the concentration of water equalizes on either side of the membrane, and that happens when what? All right, we could do the little calculation right here, but that happens when we have 270 grams per liter on one side, 270 grams per liter glucose on the other, which means the glucose concentration is the same, but also the water concentration is the same, and this membrane is going to stop moving. All right, so under these conditions, notice that the water concentration is higher on the left-hand side. That produces what we call a lesser osmotic pressure. And that allows this chamber to expand, to get bigger. Sometimes we call this solution over here hypotonic. It has less pressure when it has a higher water concentration or a lower solute concentration over here. And cells will actually do the same thing. Cells will change their shape and their size depending on the concentration of water that that they're surrounded with. And the only way that a cell will stay the same size is if the water concentration outside the cell is equal to the water concentration inside the cell. So we have to be concerned about when we transfuse somebody, what kind of concentration of solutions that we transfuse them with, because that will change the shape of their cells. So that's what we want to look at next. Okay. So it's a term that we call osmotic pressure. Osmotic pressure is the force that you have to push on that membrane to get it back to its original location right here. Okay, so it's the force that would have to be exerted to stop osmosis from happening. That indicates how strongly water wants to diffuse, right, down its concentration gradient, so it's proportional to solute concentration. So when we mix up drugs, for instance, we have to be very concerned that we mix them up in the proper way. So let's talk about the ways that we can talk about the number of particles in solution. There are three ways that we do that, and here are two ways. If we talk about a molar solution with a capital M right here, and if we want to make a one molar solution of something, we need to get a flask that's 1 liter, okay, and we're going to measure one mole of solute, like, let's say, glucose, right, and we're going to dissolve it in this bottle right here, okay, until we fill it up to exactly 1 liter mark. So how do we calculate what the weight of one mole of glucose is? How many carbons does glucose have? These are some problems for you at the end of the chapter, 6. So we look at the periodic table over here. Here's carbon. How much does every carbon weigh? 12.01. It's a little blurred out right there, but 12.01. But how many carbons are there in glucose? There's 6, so you got to multiply that 1201 times 6. That takes care of the carbon. And then remember, for every carbon, you got what? It's a carbohydrate. It's got a water molecule, right? So it's got 2 hydrogens and an oxygen. So then you also have to add, for each of those carbons, 2 hydrogens right here, plus, and that's about 1 gram per mole, and an oxygen would be 16. So it would be 2, and then one of these to the, where was carbon 12 right here, and that would tell you then what the weight of glucose would be. So you measure that weight out, all right, so, oh, look, it says 180 grams. That might be right, okay, but I would have to do the math. All right, weigh it out, put it in a a flask right here, and then you add water to it until you just get to this 1 liter mark, shake it up, it all dissolves in solution. We use this term mole because it's just a defined number of particles, and it's a huge number, right? It's 6 times 10 to the 23rd particles. That's just by definition. And this many particles of glucose weighs that much, calculated by what we see over here from the periodic table. So that's a molar solution. A molal solution is a little bit different. With a molal solution, we still calculate 1 mole of glucose, which is 180 grams. All right, we still get a flask, but now we don't fill it up to exactly the 1 liter mark. We put in exactly 1 liter of water into it. All right, so in the first case over here for a molar solution, we didn't put quite 1 liter of water. It was less than that because 180 grams of glucose takes up some volume. Right, so you have to think, well, then I can't put that volume of water in the flask for a molar solution. But for a molal solution, right, if I put in 1 liter of water and then glucose on top of that, what are we going to end up with? More than 1 liter of solution. Okay, so that's the difference between molarity and molality. All right, now there's one other just little complication that's really important. Sometimes when we put a molecule in solution, okay, it breaks apart, it dissociates. Can anybody think of a molecule that's held together very weakly so that when you put it in water, that chemical bond is so weak that it actually breaks apart into a number of molecules? Like, for instance, sodium chloride is held together by what? Covalent bonds? No, ionic bonds. Relatively weak, those bonds are broken, and now you have a sodium and chloride in solution. And osmotic properties are dependent on the number of solute molecules, just the number, not really the kind. Right? Glucose doesn't break apart into two different molecules. You put it in solution, it's just one molecule. Other molecules will break apart. And so we need to think about what the effect of that is on osmosis. And so that term is what we call osmolality. Right, so osmolality is the total molality of a solution. So let's work an example right here to give you a good feel for that. So here we have that experimental chamber. Once again, the volumes are exactly the same. And we're going to put in a 1 molar solution, a 1 molal solution of glucose and a 1 molal solution of NaCl. So the exact same number of particles in each of these chambers when it's dry. But when we put glucose in water, it does not dissociate. But when we put sodium chloride in solution, it breaks apart into 2 particles. And since it does, okay, it changes the osmotic pressure. And so now we have a 1 osmolar solution on the left. And because sodium chloride breaks into 2 particles, we end up with a 2 osmolar solution on the right. And in this particular case, in order for both sodium and chloride and glucose are what we call osmotically active, that means that they can't go across the membrane, but water can. All right, so water is at a much higher concentration on the left compared to the right, so water is going to diffuse down a concentration gradient. All right, so what kind of membrane is this right here? Semi-permeable, because water can move through, but what cannot move through? The solute. As a matter of fact, all 3 of the solutes, right? Glucose, sodium, and chloride can't move through. They're all osmotically active. So water is going to move until the osmolality of both of these chambers is exactly the same. Okay. And in this particular case, then this would be the hypertonic solution. This would be the hypotonic solution. So this chamber on the left actually shrinks inside as a result of that. Okay, so that takes us to a concept of tonicity. Now we're getting into some more physiologic kinds of concepts right here. Tonicity is the effect of a solution on osmotic movement of water. Oh, what the heck is that? What's the osmotic movement of water? Let's go over those 3 criteria for osmosis once again. What is it? What's moving? Okay, it's diffusion, which means what? It's kind of a loaded term. Diffusion is? You could say high to low or what? Passive process, so it's a passive process. What's moving? The solvent molecule, which for us is water. And how is it moving? Through a selectively permeable membrane, right? All those criteria have to be met. So here are 3 conditions, isotonic, hypertonic, and hypotonic solutions. All right, and they're going to have an effect on this cell right here, and I probably want to take just a little bit of time, if I got a marker, to show you this. Maybe you look at this in the lab. Here we have, oh good, the marker's working. Let's make three beakers right here, and we're going to put a nice red blood cell in each of these three beakers, and inside of this red blood cell, we're going to have water. We're going to have H2O, and we're going to have sodium chloride. And I just wrote sodium chloride right here to represent all the solutes that are inside the cell. So all the glucose, all the sugar, all the things that are dissolved in water. Okay, and I've forgotten. Let's just say that it is 1% NaCl. The solute constant is about 1% of the total volume. So how much water is in there? It would be all the rest, which is what? 99% water. Okay, so all of these cells are going to have that concentration of salt. Now let's put this red blood cell in 100% water, like this. Does it look like there's a big difference, okay, between 100% and 99? Does that look like a big difference? Not a very big difference, okay, but it is a little bit of a difference, so what's going to happen? Which way is water going to go? Okay, it's going to enter the cell. NaCl is osmotically active, which means it can't go through the membrane. So what kind of membrane is that? Semipermeable. So far, does that kind of look like osmosis to you? It's the solvent molecule that's moving down a concentration gradient through a selectively permeable membrane. And this cell has to do what when it absorbs that water? It's going to expand. As a matter of fact, it's going to expand so much that it's going to break apart. It's going to blow that cell up. Right, and when the cell blows up, what about life inside that cell? Voila, it's gone, right? So that kills the cell when that happens. So you have to know the name of that process. That's called, since it's a red blood cell, we call that hemolysis, right? Hemolysis, lysis is the breaking of a cell apart or breaking of something down. And hemolysis occurs when you place a cell in a hypotonic solution. Hypotonic. Oh, make sure that's an O. Hypotonic. Hypo means what? Lower than normal tension. So when it's lower than normal tension, what happens to the cell? There's not as much pressure pushing it in. It expands, and it expands so much that it hemolyzes. So a hypotonic solution causes hemolysis. All right, so what do we got? We got a blood cell over here with how much water in it? 99%. And how much NaCl? About 1%. Let's put that in a salty solution, like seawater. And let's just say that seawater has 5% salt. Okay, and how much water? 95. All right, and now, do you see a concentration gradient for water right here? There is, so that's going to move water across the membrane, but again, selectively permeable membrane, salt can't move across. So which way is water going to move? From high to low. All right, 99 is high, 95 is low, so water is going to move out, and so what's going to happen to this cell? It's going to shrink. You got to know what that's called, that process of shrinking the cell. That's probably, it's not on the board, on the screen over here. So I'll put it on the board right here. That's called crenation. Crenation is when a cell shrivels up because it's been put into a hypertonic solution. A hypertonic solution actually pushes the cell down like that, right? But you should realize it's due to the osmosis of water, right? So crenation is produced by a hypertonic solution. All right, so you got to memorize or be able to figure out how these terms match up with each other, the name of the process, right, that's produced by each of these different solutions. So then our last example right here, we've got, what, 99% H2O, 1% salt right here, and let's put it in the solution with 99% water and 1% salt. Okay, which way is water going to move? Nowhere, because it's 99% on both sides of the membrane, right? Neither is higher, So what's going to happen to the shape of that cell? It's going to stay exactly the same, nice and healthy. All right, and so this kind of solution is what we call isotonic. All right, so if you're going to transfuse or give fluids to somebody, you have to pay attention to this. And if you're going to pick a solution, maybe you ran a marathon and you're low on fluids, what kind of fluids would you want to have added to your vascular system? Hypotonic, hypertonic, or isotonic? Isotonic, so that you neither hemolyze nor crenate your cells. That's pretty important to do that. Okay, so that's the importance of that. Now, there's a little bit of difference between a hypotonic and hypertonic. When you have a balloon, okay, and you blow it up, and it's a nice big balloon, and then you blow a little bit more air in the balloon, and it blows up. What process is that like on the board? That would be hemolysis. Okay, now you have that balloon that's all in a bunch of pieces. Can you ever get the balloon back to its normal size? No. That's an irreversible process, right? So a hypotonic solution produces an irreversible process. Those cells are destroyed. Now, crenation is not irreversible. It is reversible. You could take a crenated cell like this and put it in an isotonic solution, and guess what's going to happen to it? It's going to go back to its normal shape right here. So a hypertonic solution doesn't produce an irreversible circumstance. Right? And that's why when people become dehydrated, we can rehydrate them, and a lot of times they get back to normal pretty quickly. Okay. But nonetheless, if somebody is dehydrated, we still don't want to put them in a hypotonic solution. It still should be isotonic. All right, so that's pretty much about osmosis right here. So this process right here on the PowerPoint slide, we have a normal red blood cell and an isotonic solution. All right, and then we put it into a hypertonic solution. Hypertonic means what? Extra pressure on the outside causes the cell to shrink. Does that process, and what's the name of that process called again? Crenation. Is crenation osmosis in this particular case? Yes or no? And it's really important to know why. Because what has happened when we crenated the cell? What molecule is moving? Water. Is that the solvent molecule? Absolutely. Okay, what about salt? Can it get through the membrane? No. Which means, what about this membrane? Selectively permeable. And then there are things stuck inside the cell or stuck outside the cell, so that membrane is what? Selectively permeable. Those are the three criteria for osmosis. All right, so I think you guys do a pretty good job in that in lab as well. Okay, so your body has to regulate the osmolality of solutions inside your body. Otherwise, your body's going to be swelling up, maybe hemolyzing or shrinking down. And actually, you know what? People can overdose on water. You can drink too much water, because what happens to the cells when you drink too much water? They start to swell up, okay? Maybe not to the point of hemolysis, but when you have millions, a couple billions of cells in your brain and your brain starts to swell up, right? Remember that the brain doesn't have a big place to go, because what's surrounded by? What is your brain surrounded by? Your skull, right? Which has a fixed volume. Your skull can't get bigger or smaller. So when people drink, this happened a couple of years ago, there was a contest, radio contest, how much water could you drink? And if you drank more water than anybody else, you ended up with a really nice truck. So people were really motivated to do this. Unfortunately, one person drank, I think, a gallon and a half of water, and that person's brain swelled up and it has no place to go. But think of what's the really big hole at the base of the brain? The foramen magnum. So when your brain expands like that, it gets pushed out through the foramen magnum, and you can imagine what that's like. That's not a very healthy circumstance. Unfortunately, that person didn't want to go to the hospital. They wanted that truck really bad and they died as a result. Okay, there are other kinds of conditions when people think that they're really dehydrated and they have abnormal sense of thirst where they drink too much water, their brain swells up, and they die as a result of that. Okay, there's one drug in particular that does that. Methylamine, methamphetamine, ecstasy, sometimes gives you a sense that you're dying of thirst. And there have been water overdoses as well due to that. Okay, so how does that happen? Okay, normally in the body. Blood osmolality is maintained homeostatically within what? A narrow range. It doesn't vary. It's not absolutely stable, but within a narrow range, right, of concentrations. If dehydration occurs, there are osmoreceptors in the brain, namely the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus is connected to the pituitary. It helps control the pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland releases a hormone called antidiuretic hormone. Antidiuretic hormone, I don't know if you realize, learned where that comes from yet, what part of the pituitary, but it's the posterior pituitary. We'll make sure that we know some hormones later on in the class. Okay, and let's just talk about, what does a diuretic make you do? Yeah, lose water, makes you pee. Antidiuretic does what? Makes you retain water, right? It prevents you from excreting a lot of urine. So when somebody is dehydrated, so that's the stimulus, right? Dehydration produces low blood volume. When you lose fluid from your body, your blood volume decreases. That means your blood becomes more salty, which is what? Increased plasma osmolality. Your blood becomes more salty. And the hypothalamus has a receptor for that salty solution. The hypothalamus then makes a decision on what to do. It gives you the sense that you're thirsty, all right? And what do you do when you're thirsty? You drink, so you increase water intake. Let's go to this other leg of the response loop over here. When the hypothalamus senses that there's an increased plasma osmolality, it releases antidiuretic hormone, all right, that goes to the kidneys, and then you stop producing copious amounts of urine, just very small amounts of very concentrated urine, so you retain water. So your intake increases, your retention increases, that feeds back to the initial stimulus, which does what? How does it relate to the initial stimulus? It subtracts from the stimulus, right? So if you're retaining water and you're adding water to your body, blood volume then goes back up, the saltiness goes down, right? So plasma osmolality goes down, so the response right here subtracts from the stimulus. So what kind of feedback loop is that? Negative feedback loop, and that produces what for you? Homeostasis, right? So your blood osmolality goes up and down, your blood volume goes up and down, but what? Hopefully only within a narrow range of variation. Okay. So you got to be familiar with that. That might be an exam figure. I'm not sure if it is or not. It is. Good. Okay, so be familiar with antidiuretic hormone. Okay, membrane transport systems. Sometimes there are molecules that are too big to move by diffusion, right? They can't get through little pores in the membrane. And other molecules, even though they are small, they can't get through the membrane because what can you tell me about the inner part of a membrane? Do I have a membrane real close? No, I don't, for you to look at. But what is the inner layer of the membrane made out of? The fatty acids of what? A phospholipid molecule. So membrane is phospholipid, right? So here is a nice phospholipid. I'm just going to draw a couple of molecules, but remember these are two sheets. So the polar head group is in the cytosol or in the extracellular environment, but the inner part of the membrane is made of what? These fatty acids. So that's the lipid region. That's the hydrophobic region of the membrane. So any kind of polar molecule can't get through a membrane because it can't dissolve into that polar solvent. It can't dissolve within fatty acids. All right, so polar molecules can't diffuse across a cell membrane. So there have to be protein molecules that aid in that transport. So in order for that to happen, when the molecule wants to move across the membrane, it's got to bind to a membrane protein. So binding is an important first step. All right, so a molecule has to bind to the carrier protein first before it is transported. There has to be a physical association. And that association has to obey like a lock and key model or a hand and glove model. The molecule that's being transported has to bind, and the way that it binds is that the shape of the molecule that's being transported, let's just say it's kind of round, it has to bind to something that's concave in the membrane protein. If the shapes aren't the same, then molecules can't bind to each other, right? Or maybe a better way of saying that is that the molecules have to have a complementary shape, Okay, so like a glove doesn't really have the shape of your hand, it's complementary so that it can fit together. All right, so protein carriers exhibit three criteria right here, or three characteristics. The first one is what we call specificity. All right, so carrier proteins are specific for a single molecule, and it's based on shape. So we use like a hand-in-glove example. So if the molecule that's being transported looks like your hand with five fingers, right, it can bind to a transporter molecule if it looks like a glove, okay? So that it can fit inside, and when it binds, then it can be transported. All right, so the shapes have to match up. They have to be complementary. So if you have a square-type molecule being transported, it won't bind to an active site that looks like a triangle or a circle. Right? They got to match up. Competition is the second thing that we want to consider, and that is if there are molecules that kind of have the same shape, right, there is competition for that binding site. So let's use that hand-in-glove example once again. Say you have a left-handed glove. What hand is going to fit inside the left-handed glove the best? Your left hand. But can your right hand fit in there? It can, but you're going to feel that it's really awkward, but you can get it to squeeze in there, right? So if your right hand is in the left-handed glove, can you put your left hand in there at the same time? No. So there's competition, right? So if there are molecules that are very, very similar in shape, they compete for that same binding site. Right? And then that third criteria right here, saturation, is when all of the binding sites have a molecule bound to them, like if your hand is in that glove, nothing else can get in there. So that is the criteria for transport. The hand has to be in the glove before it can be transported across the membrane. So let's diagram this out with this curve. Let's plot out the rate of transport of this molecule X across the cell membrane. So this is the rate of transport from one side of the membrane to the other against the concentration of the solute molecule. Okay, so we have a number of transporters in a cell membrane, and when the concentration of X is zero, what can you tell me about how much X is moving across the membrane? If there's none there, it's not going to be transported across the membrane, right? So we start at zero. But let's look at the solid line first. As we increase, now we add some X on one side of the membrane. So now, as long as the transporter is there, it can be transported across the membrane. So the rate of transport, what, starts to increase, okay? So it starts to bind to the transporter molecule. And as we increase the concentration, as we move to the right on the concentration axis, more of the X is going to be transported across the membrane. So, right, this line starts to rise up on the rate of transport axis over here, right? So it increases. And then we see that it starts to slow down, and actually it actually stops as we increase the concentration of X, because at this point in time, all the transporter molecules are occupied by X, right? All the hands have filled up all the gloves. And even if you have more free hands, you can't put any more hands in gloves because the gloves are all filled up. So the rate of transport cannot increase any further. When it can't increase any further, we say then that transporter is saturated. The rate of transport can't happen any faster because all the transporters are saturated. So sometimes we call that the transport maximum. When all the transporters are filled up, even if we increase the concentration of X, we can't increase the rate, then we call that the transport mechanism. Maybe I ran out of batteries. Now I can hear myself talking. I can't hear myself. The light's still on. Maybe it's the batteries that died. I can't take time to switch the battery out right now. Sorry about that. But raise your hand if you can't hear me. Do I have to take time to change the battery? Can you sort of hear me back there? I'll try to speak up to you guys. Okay. All right, so usually as the concentration of the molecule that's being transported increases, the rate of transport increases. All right, now let's just say that there's some competition. Not only do we have glucose that's being transported across the membrane, but we got a molecule that's close to glucose. What would that be? Fatty acid? Steroid? How about galactose? Six carbons, very similar, okay? Galactose, not exact fit, kind of like a right hand going in a left-hand glove, but it can still fit in. All right, and when galactose is in that transporter, what about glucose? Now it can't get transported because it can't bind to the transporter. So if we have two molecules like X and Y, look, the transport maximum is decreased. You reach saturation at a much lower concentration of what? X right here if Y is also in solution. All right, so that's what we mean by competition. So that's a pretty handy graph to look at. So it's important to know how glucose moves across the membrane. So let's talk about glucose in particular. Now, what kind of molecule is glucose? Anybody, is it polar or nonpolar? It's polar because of all the OH groups that form these polar covalent bonds with hydrogen, right? And so glucose dissolves in water very, very easily. So here we have a nice cell membrane. Glucose concentration is high on the outside, it's low on the inside. So which way does glucose want to move? Does it want to move across the membrane based on the concentration gradient? Yes, you're all shaking your head yes, because it's high. And which way does it want to move? It wants to move inside. And is that going to be a passive or active process? Active or passive. Okay, remember, passive is going from high concentration to low. Okay, that's a passive process. So you said inside the cell, high concentration to low, that's a passive process. And that's just going to be diffusion, right? It could be osmosis, but glucose is not the solvent molecule. It's a solute, so it can't be osmosis. All right, so glucose wants to enter the cell, but can it? Look at this big nonpolar region inside the membrane. What kind of molecule was glucose?
Polar.
Is polar. The membrane is nonpolar. They repel each other. So glucose can't by itself get through the cell membrane just based on that property. So there has to be a transporter in the membrane that allows that to happen. And here it is. Here's a glucose transporter. It's a protein, and it just so happens that it has some hydrophobic groups in this part of the protein that like to dissolve in the membrane, and then there are some hydrophilic groups over here and over here that like to dissolve in the water part, the extracellular water or intracellular water. So it's happy sitting right smack in the middle of the membrane right here. So, and it kind of acts, it can act like a teeter-totter. It can be open to the outside of the cell, or it can be open to the inside of the cell by a little conformation change. It's going to change its shape, all right? But it can't be open to both the outside and the inside at the same time, right? Either one or the other. When, under normal conditions, this transporter is going to be open to the outside world, so glucose will diffuse in, and the shape of this glucose is kind of like a stop sign. Remember, it can form that cyclic ring, and it can bind to this transporter if the shape of that binding site is what? Complementary to the shape of the glucose molecule. Not that glucose is really that shape, but it's kind of close. So it can bind to this part of the protein, and what it does, this is what the protein experiences. Okay, you're sitting next to your friend, take your index finger and kind of gently poke them in the side. What's going to happen to your friend? Are they just going to sit there and go, oh, I didn't feel anything? No, right? They're going to move, right? They're going to be tickled or move somehow. It doesn't even have to be a really hard poke. So same thing for this protein right here. When glucose pokes it, when it binds to this receptor site right here, it's going to change conformation. And now it closes to the outside, opens to the inside, and glucose now is inside the cell. Right? But nonetheless, it's still a passive process, right? Doesn't require energy because it went from high concentration to low. But that's why binding to the protein is so important. Okay. So just binding to the protein is enough of an energy change to change the conformation. Now, what are some bonds that give conformation to a protein? Some are extremely weak associations. What's the weakest kind of association? Van der Waals forces. The next strongest, but it's still very weak. Hydrogen bonds. And then we have some maybe ionic bonds, a little bit stronger. And this binding right here certainly is not going to break any covalent bonds. But van der Waals forces, maybe some ionic bonds, hydrogen bonds will be rearranged, and this protein will undergo conformation. Okay, so normally, glucose cannot enter cells unless these transporters are in the membrane. And it's controlled by insulin because these transporters are usually held in reserve in vesicles inside the cell that we call endosomes. So these transporters are active, but since they're not in the cell membrane, they can't allow the uptake of glucose, even though it's high glucose on the outside and low on the inside of the cell. The insulin signal then moves this vesicle over to the plasma membrane, and it's the same membrane that we have right here, so they fuse together. So now where do you have these transporters? Inserted in the plasma membrane, and now they can act as a mechanism for glucose to enter the cell. Okay, so we call this facilitated diffusion because why? Is it active or passive? It's passive, but you still need these transporters to be inside the membrane. If they're not there, glucose won't get in the cell. So facilitated diffusion still does not require ATP. But there are many processes that do require ATP, and we call those active transport. And which way are molecules going to be transported? From low to high concentration. Okay, let's look at calcium right here. So we have low calcium inside the cell, high calcium outside. So calcium does not just want to move by diffusion. Right? Calcium will move around inside the cell. It can bump into a protein carrier molecule right here. Some carriers are very specific. Maybe it will only allow calcium. Maybe this one would allow calcium, sometimes a little bit potassium. But let's just say it's very specific for calcium. And when it binds right here, all right, it's kind of stuck in limbo until something else happens. Just by binding calcium is not going to change a conformation of this protein. But another part of this protein, maybe in this location right here, has to bind ATP, and then it's going to break ATP down to ADP and inorganic phosphate, and when it does, it's going to release a lot of energy. So now your friend didn't just like poke you in the side with their finger, they had a taser. And what did they do? Put that on their side, they pulled the trigger, and now what are you going to do? You're really going to jump, right? So now this protein undergoes a big conformation, and it allows calcium then to get to the outside of the cell. So calcium can go from low concentration to high if there is an energy source that causes a big conformation of this protein right here. And what's the energy source inside your cells? ATP. Okay? It has released that energy. Okay. And most of the energy that your body uses is used in this process right here, is used to drive pumps, ion pumps in cell membranes. Okay, so let's look at, in particular, one very important pump. What does a pump do? It takes something from low concentration to high, right? A pump is something active. It just doesn't happen automatically. And the energy source is going to be one possible energy source is ATP. We'll further define that. Here is a pump. And this is a pump that's going to move both potassium and sodium, so we call it the sodium-potassium pump. And this is a good slide to look at, might even be an exam figure, because it shows you the inside of the cell and the outside of the cell, and by the boldness of the type that we have for potassium and sodium, it tells you under normal circumstances where potassium is high concentration and where it's low, and where sodium is high concentration and where it's low. So you just got to memorize this. Where do we have high potassium concentration in a normal resting cell? It is inside. Okay, and where and low on the outside then, of course. And what about sodium? Where is it high? It's high outside, right? So that's just a basic state of life. You've got to just memorize that. Sodium is always going to be high on a normal living cell on the outside, potassium on the inside. And one of the reasons why is because of the sodium-potassium pump. It's going to be pumping both sodium and potassium. So here is a membrane protein. It can move potassium to the inside of the cell, even though it's high on the inside, so it's going to go from low to high. What kind of process is that again? Active or passive? That's active. And sodium is going to go from low to high. What kind of process is that? That's active. What do you need? You need energy, and in this particular case, in the form of ATP. The sodium-potassium pump is a little strange in that it doesn't move equal amounts of sodium-potassium when it's pumping. It moves three out, and only three sodiums out, and two potassiums in. All right, that's another thing you just kind of have to memorize. Okay, so three sodiums out for every two potassiums in, and it uses ATP to do that. So that's an active transport. There's another way that things can move from low concentration to high, Okay, using a different kind of energy source besides ATP. So let's look at this analogy on this slide. So here we have like a wedge, we have like a hill right here, and you can jump off the hill, there's a teeter-totter, and we got some molecules. All right, so what is the process of going of sodium, the sodium ion, going from low concentration to high concentration, moving up this hill? That's active transport. And in this particular case, all right, what is being used to move sodium from low to high concentration? It's using ATP. And if ATP is the energy source for moving something from low to high concentration, we call that primary active transport. All right, so when ATP is being used up to maintain a concentration gradient of sodium, we call that primary active transport. Now, when sodium's up on top of this hill, what does it want to do? It wants to go back down. Right? It just wants to roll back down the hill or jump off, right? And that would be very natural. That would be a very passive process, right? It doesn't require energy to go back down. But there is energy in sodium by being on top of the hill. So there are some protein molecules in membranes that allow sodium to go back down the hill like this, drop it off the cliff, but it's connected to this teeter-totter right here, and when it hits this one end of the teeter-totter, what can it do to glucose? It can flip it up in the air. It can make glucose go from low concentration to high. What do we call that when something goes from low to high? That's active transport. Now, over here, do you see any ATP being used? No. There's no ATP being used. It's the gradient of sodium that's being used. So there is energy stored anytime you have a gradient of molecules. There's energy in that gradient. The energy of the gradient is being used to move glucose from low to high. So if you see a transport process where there's no ATP being used, we call that secondary active transport. If something goes from low to high, it's active transport, no matter what. But if there's no ATP, it's secondary active transport. But if you see ATP being used, it's what? Primary active transport. So both are active. One is primary, the other is secondary. Okay. Might have to look at that slide just a little bit. All right, furthermore, we need to define our terminology just a little bit. So we have sodium going from high to low, okay? And what about glucose? Is it going the same direction? No, it's going the opposite direction. Sometimes molecules across the membrane can go in same directions or opposite directions, and we call it something a little bit different. So here we have a transporter, okay? Sodium, why can't sodium get across the membrane? Because it's polar, right? It likes to dissolve in water, not the oily part of the inner parts of a cell membrane. Glucose can't get across the membrane, right, because of the fatty acids right here. All right, so we have a transporter that will bind both sodium and glucose, right? And we have sodium at a high concentration under normal conditions where? Outside the cell, low inside the cell, so sodium wants to go inside, and that's an energy source. The concentration gradient is an energy source. And then we have glucose that's high on the inside because cells should have glucose to stay alive, and it's low on the outside. So how is glucose going to go from low to high? What kind of process is that going to be? That's got to be an active transport process. Okay. But you see ATP being used right here? No. So is that primary or secondary active transport? It's got to be secondary active transport, and since both sodium and glucose are going in the same direction, we call that co-transport or a symport. So this protein right here is a symporter. Glucose and sodium are going in the same direction. Some transporters, you might have the sodium moving in one direction and the other molecule going in the opposite direction, right? And that's what we call counter-transport or an antiporter protein, when the solutes move in opposite directions. But again, ATP is not being used, just a gradient of one of the molecules is going to be used as an energy source. Okay, so can you see the difference between co-transport and counter-transport? What does this slide show? Co-transport or counter-transport? Co or counter? Both glucose and sodium are going in the same direction. You see them both ending up inside the cell, so that is symport or co-transport. And co-transport or counter-transport are always going to be what kind of transport? Secondary active transport, because it doesn't use ATP. But something is going from low to high. glucose in this example. Pretty important mechanism. Okay, so here is, let's just say, I think this is a kidney tubule. So here is a cell that makes up a kidney tubule, and if you have really good photographic memory, you can flash back to your anatomy class, and we use kidney tubules to demonstrate what? A simple cuboidal epithelium. And here is a nice cuboidal cell, right? And here is the lumen of a kidney tubule right here. And this kidney, what does a kidney produce? Urine. And you excrete that from your body, right? So things that are in urine, you will excrete. And then here we have like a blood vessel. Okay, we have blood in there. This is inside your body. So here we have glucose in a kidney tubule. If it stays in this kidney tubule, where is it going to end up? Outside your body. Okay, yeah, you're going to excrete glucose. But glucose is an important energy molecule. That's what helps fuel mitochondria to make ATP. So you don't want to get rid of it, right? You don't want it running out of your body right here. That would be like going to the gas station, filling your gas tank up with gasoline, and then taking an ice pick and putting a hole in the gas tank. Really silly to do that. So your body wants to absorb as much glucose as possible, even though there's very low concentration in the urine and high concentration in your body, you don't want to lose any. You still want to take it from what? Low to high. What is that going to require? Going from low to high. Yeah, it's active transport. So let's look and see how that is. So here's the basal membrane of a kidney tubule. Here's the apical surface of a membrane. And you see it looks a lot different, and there are different proteins that are inserted into the membrane right here. Here is a cotransporter that's going to use the gradient of sodium. It's high in the kidney tubule, low inside the cell. Remember, sodium is always high outside the cell. Sodium wants to rush in. It's going to enter the cell, but because of this cotransporter right here, it's going to allow glucose to move inside the cell as well. Okay, so this step number two right here, it's cotransport, and glucose is going from low to high. Is it active or passive? Glucose going from low to high. It's active. All right, do you see ATP being used? No. So is it? It is secondary active transport. So anytime you see cotransport, symport, amport, you know it's secondary active transport. It's using the gradient of sodium to enter the cell. So now we have high glucose inside the cell, and we have relatively low inside the blood, so what does glucose want to do? It wants to leave the cell, go into the blood, and then you will have what? Resorb glucose from the filtrate right here and put it in the blood. But remember, glucose can't get through the cell membrane because it's a polar compound, but it can diffuse, so what do you need right here? Just a carrier molecule to where when it binds to that molecule, it changes conformation, and it allows glucose just to diffuse through this membrane protein through the cell membrane. So that's what we call facilitated diffusion. It's facilitated by this carrier molecule right here. All right, but now we've got sodium building up inside the cell. Do we want that to happen? No, we want sodium high on the outside, low on the inside. So here is that sodium-potassium pump, right? And that's going to pump sodium out of the cell, but it's going to require ATP. So what kind of process is that? That's primary active transport. So we got secondary active transport here using the gradient of sodium. Here's primary active transport because you see ATP is being used. Okay, so that's a really cool exam figure. You got to get a feel for how that works. Okay, you can start off by memorizing it, but it's best to get a pretty good feel for how that's working. All right, so bulk transport. Some molecules are just too big to have membrane transporters carrying them across the membrane. We call that bulk transport. They actually have to be moved inside of a vesicle when the cell membrane invaginates like this. And this part of the membrane is being pushed and pulled by microtubules and microfilaments inside the cell. And that all requires ATP to move the cell membrane around like that. So it forms this little dimple. Particles can then, just by diffusion or motion inside the extracellular fluid, find their way inside this little dimple, and then finally the membrane pinches off and it forms a vesicle inside the cell. So now these particles that were outside are effectively inside the cell. And bulk transport is an active transport process that requires ATP. So you could actually draw in some ATP molecules here, but we're not going to look at the exact mechanism and how the microfilaments attached to the cell membrane and how they push and pull. Just take it from me that they do that, okay? All right, so this process of taking things inside the cell is called endocytosis. The reverse process can also happen where you have a vesicle, maybe with some proteins or modified proteins inside of a vesicle, which then can hop a ride on a microtubule to the cell membrane where it fuses, and then the interior contents of that vesicle are released to the outside of the cell. We call that secretion, and again, that's active transport. That requires ATP. That's what we call exocytosis. Furthermore, you should probably know that endocytosis could be broken down into two kinds. There's something called phagocytosis, if indeed they are solid particles, right? And pinocytosis, if these solute particles are really dissolved in solution. So that would be like drinking tea or coffee or something. So pinocytosis is cell drinking, and phagocytosis is cell eating. Okay. So is bulk transport a form of passive or active transport? Draw some big ATP right here. And you'll know, right? So, good. Okay. Membrane potential. Well, we're not going to get through this chapter today, I don't think. So, you got to come back Tuesday. But membrane potential, we're not done. I'm going to start. Okay. Can also be called membrane voltage. We know that some particles have an electronic charge, electrical charge on them. Some have a negative charge. Could you give me an example of a particle that has a negative charge? We worked with one on the board, I think. Chlorine, yeah, it's an ion. What? It's a monovalent anion. All right, some particles have a plus charge, like sodium, a monovalent cation. Potassium is also a monovalent cation. And you can tell if you look at this chart over here, because where's sodium and where's potassium? They're in the first column over here. These are all going to be the monovalent cations. What are all these over here going to be, even though we're not going to deal with all of them? These are going to be the bivalent or divalent cations, right? Then trivalent. Then over here, right, we have all the monovalent anions, right? So that you don't really have to know that, but it kind of sort of makes sense, I think. You shouldn't really be afraid of the periodic table. It actually makes a lot of sense when you start to work with it and look at it, okay? All right, so what does membrane potential mean? It's the same thing as a voltage, and a voltage just means, or membrane potential just means that there is a bunch of positive charges over here and a bunch of negative charges over here. Or there's a bunch of positive charges here and no charge over here. So what is that? That's a concentration gradient of what? Not necessarily just particles, but electrical charge. So if there's a concentration of electrical charge, that's really a source of energy that can be used. Right, and as a matter of fact, y'all have those in your pockets. Some of you, I know, even have two or three of these in your pockets. What is a device that stores energy for you in the form of an electrical gradient? That is a battery. Right, a battery has a couple compartments in there, and it puts a bunch of negative charges in one compartment and no electrical charges in another. And when you hook the two terminals up with a wire, what happens? Those electrical charges like to positive and negative attract each other, and so if these electrons will flow through that wire. Okay. And every cell in your body acts like a battery. So here we have a cell right here, and it's going to be under normal resting conditions. It's going to be negative on the inside and positive on the outside. Right, so whenever you have a separation in charge, you have what? Basically a battery. And we're going to see how that happens. The way that it gets started is that we have a bunch of proteins inside the cell. And proteins are huge. And even DNA, it has a negative charge. So most proteins are a negative charge, and DNA has a negative charge on it. So there's a big negative charge inside the cell. Right, that's what really helps develop the membrane potential. So if there's a big negative charge inside the cell, what can you tell me about these positive charges that are on the outside? They're going to be attracted to come in because, right, opposite charges attract each other. Okay, so there are some positive charge particles that can enter the cell, and that's potassium. So they can actually diffuse in. Sodium can't get inside the cell because it can't get through the cell membrane. There are special pores that are always open for potassium, so potassium can leak inside the cell. So if we have high potassium, let's think of this condition. Let's erase these proteins and DNA inside the cell. Let's get rid of all these negative charges. And let's just think of potassium, which has a positive charge. And let's put a high potassium concentration on the outside and none on the inside, and we put a little pore so that potassium can actually go through the membrane. It can go through the membrane. Is potassium going to move through the membrane? If it's high on the outside, low on the inside? Absolutely. And when will it stop diffusing in? When the concentration is equal, right? So when you have an equal concentration of potassium, it's going to stop moving. All right. Now, let's drop all these ions back inside the cell, these anions. So now, you have equal concentration of potassium, but now we added so many of these anions that now the inside of the cell is negative. And don't forget, what's the charge of potassium?
Positive.
It's positive. So now, what happens to potassium? Will the concentration be the same on either side of the membrane? The concentration, in terms of diffusion, right, it's equal, the concentration is equal, but now the charges interact, and these negative charges are going to pull some additional potassium inside the cell. So eventually, what's going to happen? You're going to have more potassium on the inside than the outside, and a new equilibrium is going to be formed. Potassium wants to leave because of concentration gradient. Right, it wants to go from high to low, but it can't because it's being attracted by the negative charges inside the cell. All right, so at that point, a new equilibrium is established, so potassium will neither enter or leave, but it's going to be high potassium on the inside, low potassium on the outside, and now you have a voltage difference, and this thing starts to act like a battery. Okay, let's see what this next slide is. And we can measure it. We can actually measure that with a voltmeter. We can actually stick a little electrical probe on the inside of the cell and keep one on the outside and measure that the inside is negative compared to the outside, and it's going to be about 90 millivolts. A millivolt is 1/1000th of a volt. Okay, so 100 millivolts would be 0.1 volt. So that's actually a fairly big voltage. All right, so every cell in your body acts like this thing right here. All right, so the new equilibrium is established to where potassium is high. It wants to leave by diffusion, but it's also being pulled in by this electrical attraction. So you got more inside the cell. And then we can measure that difference in electrical charge. That's what we call the equilibrium potential, the equilibrium voltage, because of these anions that are inside the cell. So next time, I think we're going to start right here with the Nernst equation, which is a pretty simple equation. You could practice that one at home before Tuesday. Okay, sign-in sheet. Don't forget the sign-in sheet. You got it right here. And I was recording the whole time. That's good. Sometimes I hit the off button when I clip it to my shirt.